Hello, everyone out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network, the network of podcasts for all things pop culture for NPR Illinois Community Voices. I'm your host today, Craig, and joining me is my co-host, Larry Smith. How are you?
I'm good, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing great. This is the first show we have done together since we introduced your show, Convince Me, to the feed about 6 months ago or so. And I've got to say, your show is incredible. So people should go out there and listen to Convince Me with Larry Smith. It's great.
Well, thank you, Craig. I appreciate it. But that's actually, we actually have done two shows together because we had the great debate between the streaming services that we did.
But we're not going to mention that because Disney Plus, you were the referee of the streaming service debate.
Yes,
and you were bribed and you colluded with Netflix to give them the victory.
This is fake news.
But yes, we are so excited to have a wonderful conversation today with another podcaster, but also an actor and comedian in his own right. We get to talk to him a lot about his career in improv and in acting and the experiences that he's had with that, but also particularly his podcast, Dead Eyes. So we're talking today to listen to Dead Eyes. I can't suggest it enough. Larry, your thoughts on it? I know you had just binged through the series again.
Yes, and I'm with you, Craig. I cannot tell, especially performers. Anyone that's a performer that's listening to this, you will get a lot out of this. And it's not just for performers. Anyone can listen to this and enjoy this story and enjoy this journey. And Connor presents himself in such a humble way, and this whole experience is humble but inquisitive, and there's nothing malicious behind any of this journey. It's just him trying to figure it out. But yes, for myself, from a performer's standpoint, man, does so much of this hit home. And he talks to all types of people, D'Arcy Carden, Paul Feig, Judd Apatow. He's talking to so many people that are relating to him in the, I've had these disappointments. I've been kicked to the side. I've had this happen to me and yet I persevered. And that's really, I think, ultimately what the podcast is about. So yeah, I'm with you. I cannot suggest it more for people.
And in case you don't know what Dead Eyes podcast is, the premise of the show is that Connor was hired to play a bit role in Band of Brothers. And then when he got to set, he was notified that Tom Hanks wanted to see him again because he wasn't sure about the gig. And so he had to re-audition in front of Tom Hanks. And the talent agent at the time told him that Tom Hanks thinks you have dead eyes. And so that failure, so he ended up getting booted off of Band of Brothers, not being in that show. And so that failure kind of, it affected him and it kind of followed along with him, but he's obviously worked it out since then, and he's doing very well for himself. So being able to look back at that and have such an iconic America's Dad in Tom Hanks be part of this connected failure story, but also be able to talk about the successes he's had since then and the growth that he's had since then. It's just a remarkable podcast. I can't recommend it enough. If you are fans of Dead Eyes and listening to us, just so we can do this right at the very beginning, I mentioned you can listen to Larry Smith on Convince Me with Larry Smith. I also host a podcast for the network called Beyond the Mouse. We do all things Disney. So please feel free to check us out with that as well. But I think we're ready to get into the interview, right?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Okay. Here is Connor Ratliff. And welcome to the Front Row Network, NPR Illinois Community Voices podcast. Connor Ratliff, the host of Dead Eyes podcast. We're so excited to have you here today, Connor.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. You know, I need to tell you a story first before I ask you my first question.
Okay.
So many times, for me at least, podcasting can become therapy for someone, and you never know, you never really get a chance to talk to the people that you have these weird coincidences with. So my brother lived in the same town as I for basically our entire lives. And he had a political position here in Springfield, Illinois. That political position, because it was a political position, went away. And suddenly he found himself finding a job in Jefferson City, Missouri. And so all of a sudden, I am out for a run. One of my friends had suggested Dead Eyes as a podcast to listen to. And all of a sudden, you say that you're from Jefferson City. And I'm like, oh my goodness, like literally this is happening at the same time. This coincidence is happening. So not only did your podcast, it was a weird coincidence to at that time when we kind of had some weird family issues going on to have that, but also the fact that, you know, your story, it's really truly something that I think anyone that's ever done any kind of performance to can relate to and can feel some kind of, like I said, therapy through the ears. So I never get a chance to like tell podcast hosts that have a weird or kind of off the wall impact to me, to themselves. So I have the chance to do that now. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
For all of that. I mean, it's so cool to be able to interact with you and to have that opportunity.
Yeah. It's such a strange thing too. I mean, I was born in Jefferson City and, I lived there until all through, you know, until I went off to college and, it's, you know, not a big place. It's, you know, it's where the state capital is. It's where the state government was. Not a big place. So it's not a town that comes up much in conversation with anyone. So anytime someone's been there or heard of it, it does feel like, oh wow, how did you, you know, why were you there? You know, it's always, those kind of little connections are, there's so many of them that, even doing the podcast, a lot of times there are little details or weird coincidences that we can't even get into because we'd be like, well, that would take, you know, 5 minutes to unpack and we would be so far off course. But it is funny once you start sort of picking at any story and trying to connect it to the larger world, sometimes you're stretching it, but sometimes these little connections just happen and they feel, it's always a weird sensation.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we're so happy to have you again today. And you know, that's my first question for you. First of all, maybe afterwards we'll have to get my brother Scott some suggestions on where to go in Jefferson City. But no, what's your origin story? How did you come to wanting to get involved in acting and in theater? What was your start in Jefferson City like?
Well, when I was growing up, my dad was on TV. He was a local weatherman, and he hosted a kids show host Monday through Friday. And my mom did community theater. So I both of my parents, as far as I was concerned, were performers. You know, I would watch my dad sort of improvising with puppets on his TV show, and I would go see my mom in plays. And then at a certain point, when I was about 10 years old, I started doing plays. And that's, you know, I was very interested in, my dad had been an actor in Chicago, before I was born. And it just seemed natural to me because it was what my parents were interested in. So it became the thing that I was interested in too. And even things that I would do later on, like I didn't get into doing improv until I was in my 30s. And that was something that my dad had done in Chicago back in the early 1970s. So I think sometimes it's just, you know, the thing that you're exposed to, when you're growing up, you know, if my dad's thing had been in sports, maybe I would have been more invested in sports or something, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I can understand that. Larry, you had a question for him.
Yes. Because I am the master of bunny trails. I know we asked you to come on and talk about Dead Eyes and a few other things, but I am definitely going to take us down a left turn here.
Oh, I love it.
Can we talk about Dan Miller, please?
Oh, okay. So Dan Miller is a short film that I was in a few years ago. Absolutely.
It was, it packs so much into 15 minutes. It is, you're perform, and I'm going to gush.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Your performance is powerful and yet subtle and understated. There is a palpable loneliness to this man and then a panic that comes when he's thrust into fame. Just the scene where you sit down to eat your sandwich alone.
Yeah.
is the sound editing on that one. Whoever was the sound editor did an amazing job. But I have so many points on this that I could probably do a whole podcast alone on it. But let's, yeah, I want to get into this.
Well, first of all, this is I believe this is still something that you can find online. You can find this. I think it's on Vimeo. And this is a you get to a certain point, or at least I did when I was performing at UCB, where you'd start getting requests. Hey, I'm making a short film, or I'm doing this, or I'm doing that, and you learn pretty quickly that, like, most of the time, you want to say yes to things, but once you have a few bad experiences, you get gun shy because you find yourself, there are things that I've said yes to as favors that then you find yourself halfway through them and you're like, oh my God, this is going to be embarrassing if anyone sees this. And Dan Miller was one of those things where when they asked me to do this short film they were doing, you can usually tell if someone sends you a script and if you read the first couple of pages of it and you like it, it's probably good. And if you don't like it, it probably is not good. It's just you but you won't. It's hard because most things in this world, if you're, it's hard to find the instinct when you have when you're coming from a blank slate, because most TV shows or movies we watch, we have some sense before we watch them about people are saying this is good or people are saying this is bad, or even just the fact that it got made is already someone vouched for it, But with the script, you're like, am I missing something? Am I not getting it? And with Dan Miller, I looked at I think a couple of examples of things that the filmmakers had made, and they looked good. They looked well made. And I read the script they'd written. I thought, well, this sounds interesting. And they were like, we're going to film this and it'll be a couple of days in California, and then we're going to fly to Japan and we're going to film for a few days in Japan. And it wasn't I wasn't my only thing was, like, I don't want to lose money doing this. Like, because sometimes you agree to do something and then you find, you're like, oh, this is costing me money to do this. But they had all their ducks in a row and they knew what they were doing. And having said that, it was still very much a guerrilla production. One of the things when we were filming in Japan is that there are no permits, apparently. This is what we found out, that, like, if you're making a movie, you just do it. And if someone tells you go away, you go away. And so everything that, but they had figured out, like, it's because I think it's, I think when you look at it, and there was a period where there was talk that it could become a TV series, that could be like the pilot for an ongoing something, which unfortunately never happened. But when you look at it, like the scenes in the airport, basically the film is about a guy who goes on a business trip to Japan and then finds out that his image has been used illegally by an ad agency and has become a phenomenon. So he's basically turned into an advertising icon. He's a and everyone recognizes Dan Miller. Dan Miller, everyone recognizes him. And so my character shows up at the airport and is immediately like swamped by, like, crazed fans. And the place where they shot that, because obviously, like, shooting in an airport is, that's a hard permit to get. You know what I mean? Like, basically, they found a location that was not, it looks like it's an airport, but it's actually like a bus terminal that's adjacent. So, like, once you've come through airport security, this is where you, so it had all the details of an airport without any of the security of an airport. And they were just very clever about the way they made it. And I could tell while we were filming it, I thought, I knew this was going to look good. And I, and it was, it was a, I thought it was a great experience getting, I'd never been to Japan before. And I'm not a really good traveler without a purpose. I kind of, if I have a meeting to go to or an improv show to do or a workshop or something, I can go anywhere. But I don't think I would just go to Japan. But if I have a reason, I love doing it. Like, and so it was a great opportunity to just, be in Japan. I spent a lot of time, this is going to sound perhaps pathetic, but I spent a lot of time in Tower Records in Japan because it still exists over there. And it was after Tower Records had closed in America, and it really was kind of like, it was like seeing someone that I thought had died. It was really kind of like, oh my God, there's a Tower Records, and it's like packed, and it's like eight stories. And, you know, there were whole floors where I'm like, I don't know any of the music on this floor, because there'd be a whole floor that was just Japanese pop music. And I was like looking around at everything and trying to find, like, I don't want to waste my trip to Tower Records. I want to buy something here that I can't get anywhere else, you know. But it was very exciting to go make a film over there, and to be making a good film, and then a film that people liked. And I do think that, like, that is a film that, like, I have clips on my reel from that film, and I think I probably have booked work because of people seeing that film, because it's I think there was one experience when we were filming the part where I'm trying to walk around incognito, where I've like changed my clothes and I'm walking through an area. The director of the film, there was a sound guy who was like local. He was local, but he was basically an American expat. He'd been living and working in Japan for, you know, 20 years or something. And there was a part where we were walking down the street, and there were some guys who were looking at us. And the director was very like enthusiastic and animated, but he was also kind of like, no, like, sir, can you please move me? Like, he was sort of like trying to control people. And one of the people that he like kind of told to move or get out of the way or something, the sound guy immediately was like, we have to leave. And we were like, what? And he's like, we have to leave. And he said, the people that, I'm going to forget the name, the Japanese mafia, that's like the Yakuza. He said the guys that the director had just like shushed or pushed were like Yakuza. And the sound guy was like, who was a big, you know, strong guy, was not an easily intimidated guy, but he was like, we have to leave this street now. And the director wasn't hearing. He was like, no, we need another shot. And I was like, I'm not going to start something here. And
you just went from Dan Miller to John Wick in one fell stroke.
It was very, I'm just remembering that now. I haven't thought about that in years, that, you know, we were guerrilla filmmaking on the streets and not necessarily understanding, you know, social cues that other people would know to, you know. And I trusted this guy's, this guy was not a paranoid guy. I think he was genuinely like, we need to get out of here. We need to film this on a different street, like a mile from here, you know?
Well, yeah. when Larry sent me this film, the short film, it was like, he was like, you need to watch this. I'm over here crying. You know, you need to see this. So we'll definitely include the link to it in the show notes on this, because like it's 15 minutes and it is tremendous. It's a great story. They do a great job, and your acting is phenomenal in it.
So mad when it ended. And by mad, I was just like, no, there's more to this story. Give me more to this story.
Well, I mean, maybe it could still happen at some point. I think we'd have to reshoot the pilot or have like a 10-year time jump or something. But
I don't know, Connor. You are talking to two hosts from NPR Community Voices. I think we can make it happen. Our influence, right, specifically.
Right. You're going to give us the green light?
We're on. We're on.
That's right.
I'm happy to continue the story on public radio. I do think that it's a good example of whenever people, you know, because of the premise of the podcast, you know, people joke a lot about, oh God, you know, like, oh, but you had dead eyes, or you had that, you know, so it's become like a common joke. I do think it may be one of the best examples I could point to of like really good eye acting on my part throughout the film.
Because that's something I was going to point out, is there, you have so few speaking, like you speak very little. Yeah. Most of it is physical and emotional reaction, and I'm watching it, and I said out loud, I was like, take that, dead eyes, shut up, because you know, I was like, I don't know what they're talking about. I was so angry.
There's the boardroom scene where I go into this office, just on a technical level. I was very aware of, like, you know, wanting to make my eye movements very small. It's hard to control your eyes when you're acting, but I was sort of like making sure that I looked at each person that I was sitting across from, and the shots they ended up using in the movie, I was like, oh yeah, this is like very like precise eye acting on my part.
Yeah, and it was some beautiful moments in there where it went from frustration to confusion to anger to it wasn't acceptance yet, but there was just that moment of when the gentleman said, or you can enjoy what we've built for you.
Right.
And there was that beautiful little light bulb started to go off. And that's quite, again, I'm not ashamed of it. I'm a big furry man that can admit to things. That's when I just couldn't stop crying. 'Cause it was just this, I was doing the Viking cry, choking it in and, you know, just shaking, but like, I'm fine. But when that happened, it was just tears down my face.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And I hope this is great because, you know, sometimes you do something like that and it has like a moment where people are looking at it. I'm always happy because they were really talented filmmakers and it'll be great if people will check that out and take a look, especially, you know, we're still, you know, in the middle of a pandemic. People are looking for things to watch. Here's another one.
This is, yeah. There's no excuse not to watch this. It's 15 minutes long. It's fantastic.
It's free.
Getting into more Dead Eyes proper. Larry, I think you had our first question on that.
Yeah. One of the things I did want to bring up, although again, I could talk about Dan Miller for forever. And I feel like Craig rudely cut us off, Connor. So, you know, that's fine, Craig. Thank you. but on the episode where you were speaking with Darcy Carden, you mentioned a few times that you were, you know, over the Dead Eyes incident. So because you were over it, you were adamant about, I was over it. What was, besides just, you know, I want to solve this mystery, what was the motivation to do an entire podcast about it? And also, was it like when you were, I know it's a two-parter, but was it like having to relive that moment over and over again as you were doing every episode?
Not relive it, because, you know, by the time I was, you know, doing things and performing at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, I felt good about where I was as an actor. I felt good about, you know, I didn't really care whether or not I ever did it professionally again or not. So by that point, I was really over it. And it wasn't really until, you know, there were a lot of podcasts where they'll sort of explore a story and like see all the different ways that you can like pick it apart. And I just started thinking that this was a good starting point for the kind of conversation that could go a lot of different ways. And once I started thinking about it, I thought, well, who are the people that are directly involved that I could talk to? And then who are people who are indirectly involved? Because in some ways those are, and then also I can, you know, sometimes the connection happens after I've already realized I want to talk to somebody, because in the case of the best example of that is probably like in the case of the Amy Mann episode, that was not on our list of people that I wanted to talk to because I had completely forgotten that the connection between that album and that period of time. It wasn't until Amy Mann reached out and said how much she liked the podcast, which was very early on. It was like in the first or second episode. And I was like, oh, we should have you on to, I was just like looking for a reason to talk to her. And then I was like, oh wait, there's actually a legitimate connection. And that's happened a few times where there's been someone, you know, Seth Rogen was the same, where he reached out because we'd brought him up in a non Band of Brothers connected. It was the thing that Bobby Moynihan had talked about. And then I was like, we should have you on the show. And he's like, well, you know, I did audition for Band of Brothers. And I was like, really? Oh, well, now we should really have you on the show. You know, that they're the smallness of this big world is part of what makes it interesting to me, because it doesn't take much to connect. You know, you could probably in the same way that like Craig, you were saying before about your brother and Jefferson City, that didn't take much for us to have like a connection through the place that I grew up, you know, that like when you start really looking for those kind of things, I find that more often than not, you can find them if you're really looking and you're being creative about it, you know? So it was really, you know, and once I, once also once I started working as an actor again professionally, that made it seem like more of a fun idea, because I don't think it would have occurred to me. You know, I talk early on about, in one of the episodes, about this comic strip that I drew, which was sort of a diary comic strip of the day I got fired by Tom Hanks. And I drew it close to the time it happened. And then I didn't do anything with it. Like, I didn't even try to revise it or publish it, or because I think even then I was kind of like, this feels like it's just for me. And it feels kind of sour, and it feels kind of like I'm just whining because I didn't get what I wanted. And it didn't feel like it had any usefulness. It didn't feel like this was worth anybody's time. And once I started, like, working where I'm, you know, like, I'm recurring on a couple of different TV shows, and I'm able to make my living as an actor for the most part, that it kind of started to dawn on me that it would be fun to talk about it, and that I know enough people who were, like, interesting and, you know, attention grabbing, that I could get this podcast started and people might find it interesting. Like, I knew putting the pilot together, I was like, Darcy will talk to me and people know her from The Good Place, and they know her from Barry and Broad City. You know, like, she's someone that people know. And then I was like, well, if John Hamm will talk to me about this play that we were in when I was in high school, that's its own episode. And then people will see, and then once I get, you know, if my friend Zach Woods will talk to me about my eyes or something, it really was front loading it. So, you know, I was gathering my famous, like, friends and acquaintances. And so it was sort of like chum in the water to try to, I thought if I can get a few interesting famous people, I can get both listeners and also other guests who will look at it and say, oh, this is a harmless thing to do. You know, like, I think it was just me doing it. People might be reluctant. Oh, what is this? Are you bad mouthing Tom Hanks? And I knew if I put nice famous people in early, that it would send a signal that this is not a complaining, whiny. I mean, I'm sure there are a handful of people who've listened to it who do think it is complaining or whiny, but I do think those people are either not listening, or it's a mishearing of the podcast, because I truly have no complaints. For a podcast about me not getting what I want, as of 2021, none of my complaints in life are related to me being fired from Band of Brothers.
You make a point to compliment Tom Hanks in every episode.
Genuinely.
Everyone knows, and it's fantastic.
And everybody just wanted to give him a coat the other night because he was obviously very cold while he was hosting the inaugural concert. So we just all wanted to just, you know, hug him and make sure he was warm, right?
Yeah, he hosted that thing like a champ. He was exactly who we needed to host that show. It was great. I know I've done remote, outdoor late night TV, things like that. On when I was on the Chris Gethard show, they had me do like man on the street things that were live with like a DeGiro camera. And sometimes the weather would be, and in that case, I think it was hot outside more than it was cold. But it's definitely a skill, and he nailed it every time. That's some great hosting.
Yeah, you know, and you, Larry and I were talking before you got onto the interview, and I'm totally stealing this from him. What makes the podcast so great is that it really is like a parable of the performer. And that's literally Larry's line. I'm just stealing it because it's good. But I've had those moments where even auditioning for community theater or having those moments of failure where you go through and you kind of like are thinking, what could I have done differently? Because I feel like I was right for that moment. This person did not feel that way. And in your case, you had extremely specific, oh, well, this is the reason why you were given this. But that's what makes it so universal in a sense. And so I just really appreciate being able to talk to you about that, because it really does have this relatability to people beyond even those that have went the route of going into TV and film, but even us that have had failures as performers in other venues as well. So, and you mentioned, you did mention that you became a regular on a couple of different TV shows. And even in your first episode, you mentioned that most people have probably seen you in something. And for me, that was actually Miss Maisel, because it's one of my favorite shows. And that's one of the ones you mentioned right off the bat that you were in. But I'm wondering, because you are playing more of like a character type performance, and you sometimes are walking into very established sets and very established shows. So I'm wondering if you have some experiences that are just kind of fun stories that you'd like to share, whether those are horrible or experiences or great experiences, anything that you'd like to share about kind of walking into an established show like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably have like, I have a couple of examples of shows where like my first like professional like TV, like the first role I had on a TV show like 13 years or whatever after Band of Brothers was on Broad City, and it was before, it was in their first season, so none of the actual episodes had aired yet. They'd done a web series that it was based on, but it was one of those things where, you know, I knew a lot of the improvisers who were in the supporting cast of that, and but I hadn't seen what an episode of the show was yet. And my scene was just, I was a phone operator. So you just, my shots would just cut to me and I'm like the guy on the phone. And we did it a couple times and it was pretty quick, and then it was over and they moved on to the next thing. And, but then it was weird because it was like, well, I'm on a TV show, but I didn't really, it wasn't a show I had, I'd watched the web series, but I hadn't watched, it wasn't like I was entering into an established TV series in that way. And I had a similar thing with the show Search Party, which is on HBO Max. There's still new season just came out of that. But when I was first on that, it was its first season. It hadn't aired. So it also was kind of weird because you're like, I don't, even now when I've filmed additional seasons on that show, I never, the show is still new to me when I see a new season. When I'm filming it, I have no idea what the overall plotline is. But I think the first show that I walked, that I booked, that I was already like, I was the audience and then I booked a role on it, was Orange is the New Black. And that was very strange because, you know, when you have a world in your head and then you're suddenly in a studio that's like a half hour walk from my apartment, and you walk in and you realize that this prison that I've been watching for years at this point is a series of interconnected hallways that, like one door that you always assumed led into something else actually leads into a completely, because they sort of built it like weird. There's that weird thing. I remember years ago I got to go on like a tour of the Law and Order sets that are at Chelsea Piers. And you realize that like the room where they interrogate the suspects is right on the other side of the courtroom. So they're literally like, if you were to like punch through the wall, you'd be in a, it's almost like a dream sort of, and it rewires the way you watch the show again, because now you're like, oh, I know when they film this, they're really in this. And I know when this happens, this is really what's happening, you know? And it was very like, and it was like that on Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, because, that was that the interesting thing about that was that the first scene that I did for that was a long walk and talk, which I've never done one of those before, where you have like pages of dialogue and the cameraman is literally in front of you walking backwards down a path. And we were at this state park that was standing in for like a sort of like a summer camp, like a places with, I'm blanking on the word, but like cabins, and it was like a resort. And that show has so many extras doing so much business in every shot. And I don't think I'd really noticed it when I'd watched the show. But then when we started doing it, you know, there was a guy who his job was to like run up the hill in the shot. So we were walking along this path. This guy would start at the bottom of the hill and he'd run up the hill. And every time something went wrong, he'd have to go back down to the bottom of the hill. So when they go back to one and we go back and he'd have to run up the hill. And I became very aware that if I made any mistakes that ruined a take, he would have to run up the hill again. And at a certain point, he was a young guy, he was in shape. It's not like me running up a hill, but like that was the thing I kept focusing on, because it was really hard to get to the end. And especially, like, I had a couple of lines near the end of the take that were hard not to stumble over. And the pressure was just so great, because when I'd watched the show, it just had this energy to it. And I didn't realize until filming it that that energy is actually dozens and dozens of people in every shot, walking up here, walking down there, running over here, saying, you know, like, and now I almost can't watch it the way that I used to, because now I see in every shot what I've seen in real life, which is all these individual moving parts that, that are, if you're around them in real life, it feels like chaos. When you see them on the screen, it just looks like it's bustling. You know, it's just people living their lives on camera, you know?
Well, awesome. And I know that you do a lot of, you started in improv and mm-hmm. UCB. Isn't that kind of the same from the audience's point of view? The improv show looks well put together, and I mean, it's still improv, but it's well put together. But if from the stage, there is just your inner monologue is just a scream, I'm assuming, just a cacophony of suggestions in your brain that you're trying to get out.
Sometimes I would say that was what it felt like when I was first trying to do improv. Then I got to a place where now I haven't been able to really do it for the, you know, almost a year now. But I'm rarely more relaxed than I am when I'm on stage doing improv, because part of it is it's almost like that thing in The Karate Kid where it's like you find your balance and your peace, and then you're able to fight, you know, like that. It's actually about kind of drowning out the chaos and just focusing. When I'm doing improv, you know, I'm rarely thinking of how to be funny. I'm usually just thinking about, okay, well, what does my character want? And then what's the most interesting way to, like, go about that? So when I'm doing improv, I'm trying to drown out that scream and those, you know, cacophonous voices and just focus on a couple of simple things if I can.
Sure. Well, but, you know, that's the idea that I think that I was trying to, I didn't say it very well, is essentially, you know, when you, I guess, being on set.
Yeah.
You get to see the duck's feet. Paddling.
Yeah, it should.
Everyone else.
Yeah,
when you're the duck cool on water.
Yeah, when you're watching Maisel, you shouldn't have an exhausted feeling of like, oh my god, there's dozens of people running around. It just feels like, because that's the other thing in improv, you just need to take care of the audience. Like, your first job is to reassure the audience that they don't need to be nervous for you, and it's that's sort of the same as in film or TV, like making sure that the audience is looking at what you want them to look at. It's sort of like, just, you know, focus on this. No matter how busy the picture, it's still about like focusing you on these characters in the front, and the all of the background chatter is like a texture. It's like a seasoning, you know?
Well, and I'm a stand-up comic, and so I understand that whole idea of you want the audience to not be worried for you.
Yeah.
Because if you walk up and are visibly nervous, which, you know, I was when I first started, and the audience is just like, oh no,
yeah.
Oh
yeah.
No. But if you go up and even fake confidence,
they're
more than happy to try to go along.
They'll go along until you convince them not to. like, the confidence gets you a little, it carries you a little way, and then you have to actually deliver. There's a point where you have to deliver something, or else they will abandon you.
Yeah, I've seen guys that went up, looked nervous, but knew exactly what they were doing. Yeah. And I've seen guys that have, and I say guys as a universal term, I've seen people that go up on stage with all the swagger in the world and nothing behind it. And
there's a clock on that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's, and both are beautiful to watch, because both get exactly what they deserve. And one is just one way and the other. I know,
You know,
Craig, you.
in particular, since you're talking about your experiences with improv, Larry has a great question. I'm going to jump over because my next question was about improv, and then we can come back to Larry's question. But you know, you mentioned your time with UCB, and you've been doing that for about a decade, from what I surmise, based off the podcast. We actually have a friend that's a huge fan of Dead Eyes. And so I mentioned that we had this interview, and he also does improv, and he's wondering what types of skills, what have you learned or what have you taken from improv that have helped you succeed in your acting elsewhere? What is it that you have been able to take with you from those experiences? And a shout out, I guess I should say his name, shout out to Drew. He's a very big fan of yours. He loves your show.
Hello, Drew. Yeah, I mean, I think improv made me better at listening while acting, that's one of those things that even if you're good at it, you can always, I think, get a little better at it, because that's often where you do your best acting, is when you're really clued in on what the other performer is doing and letting that sort of inform what you're doing. And I think, like, I'm trying to think in terms of... It's interesting because like shows like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, there's no improv involved at all. So the actual like skill of improv is like, it's not anywhere in the content of it, because, you know, it's very different when someone writes something and your job is to make it look like you thought of it. You know, that's different than actually thinking of what the next thing the character's going to do is. But I think there's probably, other aspects of performing scripted material where the improv allows you to be a little bit freer or looser with the way that, like, you got to get the lines exactly right. But I think that muscle that you use for improv is probably pretty helpful as far as like opening you up to different ways of saying the lines. You know, I think it probably... It's almost like, because you can't make up the lines, that part of your brain goes to, okay, well, if I have to say these lines verbatim, I'll improvise around the not the intention necessarily, but like the phrasing or the energy or the dynamic, you know, that you're using to fuel the line. I think that's probably where it's helped the most.
Awesome. Larry, did you want to follow up with your question about stand-up?
What I was going to point out, Connor, is being a stand-up comic, I like initially when you started talking, just the first episode, I could relate so much. And I think any performer, and like I said to Craig, this is a performer's parable. It is a lesson that any performer can take away. And immediately I thought, and not to make it about me, but it just to relate it to, I had a chance at a big festival last year, and was told, encouraged by a couple of the festival directors, send in your tape. They're gonna love you. We're gonna put you on. Oh. Just send it in. And I was like,
deal.
Absolutely. So I send it in, you know, and it's benefiting but like the Special Olympics is what it was benefiting in that area. And I was like, even better. I don't mind throwing money at a festival if they're doing that. And a buddy of mine, who he also had been encouraged to do the same thing. He does the same thing. And he and I are actually out on tour. We are on about a 2-week run. Mm-hmm. And we are up in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin.
Gotcha.
It is the coldest weather. And I have spent a lot of time in Chicago. And it was the coldest I have ever been in my life. And he and I went out to lunch, and we're sitting there, and we both get our phones ding at the same time. We both see that it's this festival emailing us, and we both look at each other. We're like, oh, here it goes, buddy. And we hit the email, and both of us got the, hey, we're very sorry that you weren't selected for this festival. But please, here's tickets you can attend. And we both sat there and looked at each other, and the waitress came up and said, is everything okay? And I looked at her and said, no, everything is not okay. It's not okay. And I wasn't going to drink at lunch, but now I'm going to need a double Jameson. And you're going to have to listen to this for the next 2 hours. And she was like, oh God. And then turned out that, and I'm not going to use the performer's actual name, but I'm going to use the closest I can get without saying it. It was like Nancy the football mom was mm-hmm. one of the people that got selected. And mm-hmm. my buddy that I was on tour with took my phone away from me so I couldn't look at it anymore. And then we had to go perform that night. And so I, like I said, I listened to the entire story and I'm listening to the podcast and like, I'm remembering all these moments, but then I'm laughing at these at the same time, because yeah. they're so, again, any performer can listen to this and have it be so relatable and so cathartic for failures, essentially.
Yeah. Well, because you are, you know, you are going to have disappointments in life, you know, and particularly if you're trying to, you know, work in show business or you're trying, you know, any creative field, even in non-creative fields, people, you know, they're every day, you know, every minute there's somebody out there who just got the bad news about like, oh, the thing that you were really hoping would happen didn't happen. And it's just something you have to deal with. Even just in the last year, you know, Tom Hanks had the movie Greyhound that came out, which is this, you know, World War II submarine drama. And it's built for going to see in a movie theater. And they just didn't have the option. There was no responsible way to put it out there. It ended up going on Apple TV Plus. And it's just one of those things where it's like life just sometimes hands you these, like, you know, it's not that wasn't, you know, the big news in 2020 was that, you know, Tom Hanks got COVID and recovered from it. So that puts everything in perspective in the sense of like, you know, I'm sure he was like bummed out to have put all this work into, you know, writing and producing this movie and starring in this movie. And then you don't get, your movie doesn't get to come out in a movie theater. I mean, maybe it never will be seen in a movie theater, which is an amazing thing to happen to a big movie. You know, like you make this thing and it's built for an audience to go watching a thing. And then all of a sudden a thing that's never happened before happens, which is that you can't really go to the movie theater without risking getting a disease. You know, I mean, people face these, like at every level, people face big disappointments, and handling those disappointments, it's okay to feel upset about them. It's okay to feel bad. It's okay to go through periods where you're angry or you're bitter or whatever, but it's healthy to be able to figure out how to, like, if there's any way that you can turn a bad experience into a good one. Sometimes it's not possible. Sometimes you just have something happens and it sucks and then you just move on and you never turn it into anything good. But I'm always looking to see if there's a way to, even when it comes to producing the podcast itself, you know, we were trying very hard when we had Ron Livingston, and Stephen McColl. We had two of the three actors who were in my scene. And we really made a strong, strong effort to try to get Damian Lewis so we'd have the complete cast of that scene for the season one finale of the podcast. But at that point, I had already talked to Seth Rogen and I had kind of asked him, like, hey, listen, we're working on this next episode. If we can't get Damian Lewis, will you read these lines? And there came a point we were down to the wire and we were really pushing to try to get Damian Lewis and it looked like it wasn't going to happen. And I just said, you know what? We've got Seth Rogen who's going to read these lines, which is really funny because now it's like 50% of the actors in this scene are people who got rejected from Band of Brothers. And one of them is actually now a huge movie star. And, you know, to me, it was just funny. And he also is one of the most recognizable voices in the world. And I just thought, like, this is in its own way better because what we're creating is not just me inserting myself into this Band of Brothers scene in which my character doesn't really talk, but we did the only version of that scene that stars Seth Rogen, you know, and it's, and that's a way that being an improviser, I think, has helped, is that, you know, you have to, sometimes when you're doing an improv scene, you're ready to, you're about to do something, and then someone else makes a move that makes your move impossible. And you just have to deal with it. The worst thing you can do is try to undo their move, that, that you break the scene that way. And so in some cases, you know, there are episodes where it starts off and we're trying to do one thing and it doesn't work out and we end up doing something else, and the something else is better and more interesting. And I feel that way about, you know, even in a macro sense, the whole, my whole Band of Brothers experience doing the podcast has been much more positive than I think me being in one scene of Band of Brothers would have been for me at the time. I think at the time I blew it up into this, I had lost this huge opportunity for this great experience. And that's true. I had lost a huge opportunity to potentially have a great experience. But in hindsight, I think I managed to make something that is, you know, Band of Brothers is great and it exists on its own without me. And I have made a second thing, which is less important than Band of Brothers in every way, but it has its own little corner of the universe to kind of exist in. And, you know, in some ways is this, you know, fun little supplement at the opposite end of a like four quadrant diagram. Like Band of Brothers is a, you know, this Emmy winning, critically acclaimed smash hit, you know, miniseries that people still watch today. And the far opposite corner, you have this little podcast that kind of, you know, does its best to explore these little questions and problems that we all go through, you know?
See, and I would argue with you that yours is, your podcast is just as important, but in a completely different way.
I will not make that claim.
I will.
We can make that claim for you. Yeah, you know.
Because again, it is comforting to hear someone like yourself and other actors, you know, it wasn't Matt Walsh that was talking about it, but it's still having people of that level that are still like, no, I still have disappointments. I still get kicked in the teeth. Listen to Paul Feig talk about getting just fired for no reason. Mm-hmm. And because he got fired, he went on and has become Paul Feig. It is, to me as a live performer, as a performer in general, it is so cathartic to hear other people tell their stories and to know that it isn't just, and you know, everyone knows it, intellectually, that you're not the only one getting kicked in the teeth.
Sure.
But sometimes it's nice to have someone go, hey, I've been there too. Come on, just sit with us for a while.
Yeah. I mean, like Band of Brothers is literally life or death stories. These are life or death stories. And my podcast is very deliberately, these are not life or death stories. However, that doesn't mean that in the moment, part of what I think is funny and also relatable about the podcast is that in these moments, we often feel like they are life or death. We often feel like these are make or break, unsurvivable moments of failure. And it's okay to feel like that. Like, I'm not diminishing that, but sometimes that's just a thing you need to get through. In the same way that, like, if you stub your toe for a few seconds, it will be the worst pain in the world. Now, this is not the same as if you have an exposed nerve and your teeth or something, you know, like there are levels at which you would easily trade for the stubbed toe, you know, but I think the thing that Band of Brothers and Dead Eyes share in common is, even though the scale of what's at stake is so different, is that both of them ultimately are trying to be like sincere in their storytelling. Like, we're trying to be real about it and not invent stuff and just tell the story, you know, and they're doing it for dramatic effects and we're often doing it for comedic effects. I think sincerity is the thing that I think puts it across the line, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, and first of all, podcasting is 90% self-promotion. So I need to make sure that I mention that we had a chance to interview Aaron Schneider, the director of Greyhound. And so I'll link that as well. That
Great.
was a great conversation.
I really enjoyed it. That was during the period where I was staying at my parents' house in Jefferson City, and I was just I as soon as I as soon as they announced it was not going to be able to come out in theaters and it was going to come out, I was like, we're gonna watch this, and I made a night of it where it was like I knew my dad was going to be into it, and I, we really made an evening of watching the movie on their big TV.
That movie is ten. It is a tense 90 minutes. Holy moly! It gets you in. It has like a couple minutes of dialogue. It drops you into this situation the whole time. You're like white knuckling it, and then it gets you out of it. It is a wonderful film, for sure.
It's a lot like Hubie Halloween in that way.
But as we start to begin to wrap up with you, we've got to ask some kind of more fun questions because we have to. You may have mentioned this in the show, and I may just be forgetting it, but have you officially mentioned your favorite Tom Hanks film? Or is that something you haven't touched yet?
I haven't touched on it yet, and I probably will at some point. But I'll go ahead and tell you what it is, because I don't waver on this one. I don't think. I think I've been pretty solid on it for a long time. But my favorite Tom Hanks performance, and it's in a film that I love, is A League of Their Own. And what I like about it is there's a kind of Tom Hanks performance that exists in the first half of his career that exists less frequently in the second half of his career. And League of Their Own sort of straddles those performances, because early Tom Hanks is very like is not always in, masterpiece, award bait kind of movies, but he brings an energy even to the film, his 80s films, even the ones that aren't going to be, making AFI's list of, best movies of the 20th century. He always brings this sort of like, you watch a movie like Dragnet or Turner and Hooch or The Burbs, and he just brings this quality to them that's fun and funny. And like The Money Pit is another one where it's like, I haven't seen The Money Pit in a long time, but I know that like the energy he brings to it is like part of what sells the whole movie. And then there comes a point where he starts doing a lot more serious films, a lot more films where he's speaking in a different dialect, and you don't hear that Tom Hanks voice. All the early Tom Hanks movies, he sounds like Tom Hanks. And in the last couple of, 2 decades or so, he mostly, he sounds like that when he plays Woody in Toy Story movies. He sounds like Tom Hanks. And then there's movies like Castaway where he sounds like Tom Hanks, but then he doesn't talk for a lot of the movie. But a lot of times it's like Catch Me If You Can or The Green Mile or Forrest Gump or The Terminal, where he's like putting on a different voice and you're not getting that pure Tom Hanks sound. And what I like about A League of Their Own is it holds its own with his like prestige films that he's done. He's tended to veer more towards in the second half of his filmography, but it still has that energy of Big and The Burbs and Turner and Hooch and Splash and Volunteers, like all those early ones where you just like Tom Hanks enters the film and it's like how he is when he's on a talk show or something, and you just hear him in his natural voice. So that's why, aside from it being just a great performance, he's getting to do lots of different things. He's not just playing Tom Hanks, but he's using the Tom Hanks look and sound to play a character who's funny but also going through some dark stuff.
It's such a great performance. And you know what? This past weekend, we rented and watched News of the World, and just that guy. You know, it's something about his performances and the variety that he brings to them. Like you said, more in the first half of his career, maybe than the second half, because now I feel like he needs that third Oscar. And you know, at some point, hopefully the Academy agrees with us all with that. But you know, it's just. A League of Their Own is just an incredible film.
I thought I was hoping he would get one for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. I thought he was great in that. But yeah, like he's when you think of him, he transforms himself now more. He'll play Walt Disney, he'll play Mr. Rogers, he'll play Sully. Like he disappears into more characters now And I want to see him like burst into a movie as like, hey, it's me, Tom Hanks. I'm here. You know, like I want to see that energy in a few more movies, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you.
But maybe that's boring to him. I don't know. Maybe he might have reached a point where he's like, I've done that and I don't need to do that anymore. I know what that feels like.
Yeah. Larry, did you have a question?
I just wanted to mention that at the end of the latest episode, you, and I'm going to quote your line, often the ingredients for future success are buried inside those failures. If you're not embarrassed to look at them closely, if you're, yeah, it is such a strong and, it's such a strong mantra, I guess. I don't know, I have a better term for it. And again, I know I've been bringing it back to performers and such, but I feel like that so much of this is just all about failing up, regardless of the situation, because again, you know, if this had happened, then this wouldn't have happened. It stuck with me, and it was something that I've got a few things that I stick up above my workstation. So on days when I don't feel like working, I can look up at them and go, okay, this keeps me going. And I'll be honest with you. That is one of them that is going to get stuck up there.
Oh, well, that's so nice. I mean, I think that the caveat for that is, and the caveat sort of fuels it as a way of thinking, which is that, you know, there are obviously things that happen in life that you can't recover from. And there are things that, you know, are so serious that you can't turn them into something good. But that makes it, I think, all the more, those things, I think, make it all the more imperative that if you can take a negative experience and learn from it and use it to fuel a positive experience, you should. And I think because, and I think you have an obligation to try to do that in a way, because there are people who, you know, for whatever bad luck you're having today, somebody else somewhere probably had worse luck, and in a way that they can't build it into something good. So it sort of like feels like to honor those things, which are coming for all of us. You know, at some point, everybody reaches a point where you know, your life builds to a point where you get to a thing where you're like, well, I can't build this into anything. This is the point where my life ends, or where I'm going to die, or what, you know, something really serious. And I think, like, if you do have the opportunity to, you know, you have a small failure that's devastating to you, you know, take the time you need to deal with it and then see if there's a way that you can, like, is there anything I can get out of this? Is there anything, you know, if you find yourself holding the equivalent of, like, an old piece of newspaper, maybe I can make this into a little hat or something. You know, just like, you're just looking for something that you can... if you're feeling bad, if you're going through something bad, you know, maybe it's one, you know, maybe you're unlucky and it's not something that you can use for anything positive. But then when you do have something that you can, you kind of owe it to the world, I think, and yourself to see if you can like use it, you know, because not everybody's that lucky.
Yeah, for sure.
And being able to put things out, put that content out, put that story out, like I said, to kind of wrap this in a big circle, you know, it's, you don't know what you're saying, what your words will do to someone else. And you expressing some of these thoughts and feelings and experiences through Dead Eyes, it has allowed us as listeners to be able to kind of use those as lessons and move forward with those. So just want to thank you for your time today. Thank you for the podcast. Thank you for all of that. You know, I feel like maybe towards the end here, we should ask, you've been looking at Larry and I for about an hour now. Do either of us come off as having any kind of dead eyes to you, or?
I don't think so. I feel like we're, you know, Zoom isn't always the best way of judging, because you're, as you said, you're incredibly backlit.
I am incredibly backlit right now. I look like I'm from an angel from heaven right now for people listening to the podcast.
So I've always thought of you, Craig.
But as much as you can connect through Zoom and make eye contact, I feel like we're making good, lively eye contact through all of this.
Good. Well, thank you so much.
Oh,
And
thank
we
you.
best of luck with the podcast moving forward. I am anxiously waiting to hear that day you get the interview with Tom Hanks. And I know it will happen. And it's going to be great. And then, you know, just the experiences that you have and talking to your fellow peers about their experiences as well, it really helps us as all performers, like Larry's been saying. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. And it's been great talking to you guys.
And everyone go watch Dan Miller, for God's sakes.
Yes, yeah, for sure. That was so awesome to be able to talk to Connor. He was so great and gracious with his time. You know, what's wonderful about him is that you listen to these people, you have these people in your ear, right, as you're listening to a podcast, and you sort of start to relate to that person. And it's almost like you have this connection with them, like you are friendly with them, right? But then when you get an opportunity to meet those kinds of people, sometimes that connection isn't quite there. But Connor is exactly who he is in real life as he presents himself on his show and on his podcast. And that comes through a lot in our discussion with him. And we're just so grateful for his time. So Larry, your thoughts on speaking to Connor today?
I think it was one, just a lot of fun. He's a great dude, like you said, and just really generous with his time and letting us just throw some what we might consider insightful questions, but also just some ridiculous questions at him. And just, it was nice to know that you could just have fun with this dude. Yeah, he is just exactly who he presents on his own show. And I just appreciated it.
Yeah, and you threw the Dan Miller question at him. He probably hasn't thought about that project much, but holy moly, it's a great project. You need to go check this out. It'll be, we will link it here in the show notes. And then if you're listening on NPR Illinois, it'll also be there as well. So check out that link for sure, because it's 15 minutes and it's amazing. It's amazing work.
Yeah, the filmmaker shoves so much story into 15 minutes, and Connor's performance is, and I'm not trying to be hyperbolic, it's one of the best performances I've seen on film, period. It is so nuanced, and that was the word I was trying to come up with earlier, and I couldn't, Craig, but it's nuanced. It is powerful without being over the top. It's just, it's worth everybody's time to watch it. What an incredible, as my wife pointed out when she watches, she's like, Connor should play every, quote, every man in everything ever from now on.
Yeah, absolutely. He just nails it in that part. And then the other parts that I've been able to see him in, whether that's Orange, It's a New Black, or Marvelous Miss Maisel, a lot of other parts that he's been in, it's just incredible, the work that he does. And the podcast is something that I look forward to all the time. I'm constantly refreshing my feed just to make sure that I don't miss that latest episode. And this past episode, as of the time of recording, I don't know if he would have dropped another one since then, but that conversation with Paul Feig and Judd Apatow about failure from these two kind of momentous people in Hollywood, it's that kind of thing that I think helps in a little way get you through some of your own struggles, either as a performer or in your job or whatever the case may be. In a way, it's cathartic to hear other successful people share their failure stories. And that's not to, you know, like look down on their failures or to kind of hope for some kind of schadenfreude against them. It's because we have our own failures in our lives, and to hear these people that we hold up also have those struggles, it just helps humanize them, but also humanize the situations that they go through as well.
Well, and it's also good for all of us to, again, people like Paul Feig or Judd Apatow, these big names who we think, oh, you know, they're above all this, to know that they have also been tripped and fallen on their face and gotten up and then became who they are. Not, you know, in spite of, but a lot of times it, because of whatever that temporary failure was, you know, that I know I mentioned it to you and I didn't say it on the podcast, but I'm going to do it now. The Samuel Beckett quote of ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better. And that is something that, again, as a performer, you're going to fail. You're going to fail. And just in life, you're going to fail, but take whatever lesson you can, leave the rest of the unimportant stuff, and just shoulder your way through to the next step.
Absolutely. I can't say that any better than that. So my last question to you before we depart, we asked Connor to name his favorite Tom Hanks film. And I feel like we should do the same because it's so hard to do. So I'm going to give you a minute to think. You would think that me being the Disney guy, I should say Woody, particularly in Toy Story 3. It is one of my favorite films overall. But I'll tell you what, obviously Tom Hanks, so many incredible performances, right? Philadelphia comes immediately to mind, an amazing performance. There's so many that Apollo 13, Saving Private Ryan. But I will say that if I'm just like looking for a fun Tom Hanks film to throw in and just enjoy, doesn't get better than Catch Me If You Can. That's probably what I would say. Although A League of Their Own, Connor's choice, also very high up there as well. Your thoughts on your favorite Tom Hanks film?
I can't just give one. I know because you mentioned a few. League of Their Own is always the first one that like, I say the first one. There's two that fight in my head, right? But A League of Their Own is one of my favorites. And I'll tell you real quick, I was having a night where I couldn't sleep. I got up, was sitting on the couch. My daughter was like 2 or 3. And she came out because she couldn't sleep either. I was watching A League of Their Own. And she got up on the couch with me and we sat up and watched A League of Their Own. And it's become one of our favorite movies just to watch together. A friend of mine, she was on an all ladies softball team, and they got me my own jersey and had me out there as Tom Hanks's character in A League of Their Own, screaming at people for fun. But I always have to really throw a curveball at people and tell you it's bachelor party.
Bachelor party?
Yeah,
that's nice. You caught me off guard there, incredibly.
I know. I saw it hit your ears, and you were like, "I didn't just hear what I just heard, right?"
And that's then phenomenal. I would expect nothing less from you, funny man. So we get out of here, let's go ahead and promote our own shows because we are normally, this is a shame that we're not normally a co-hosting duo, that this was a special opportunity for us. But tell me what's coming up on Convince Me with Larry Smith or what you've had recently.
Recently we had Chris Spire, who is a stand-up comic. He's been on Bob and Tom and several other radio shows, but he's also the owner of Mason City Limits Comedy Club in Mason City, Illinois. And because restrictions are being lifted, he's starting to do some more very limited shows. Recently, we've had Dan Bublitz Jr., who just filmed his first Dry Bar special, which if you're on Facebook at all, you'll see the Dry Bar specials popping up on your feed. So Dan just filmed that. We've had Jeremy Nunez, who has an Amazon Prime special. He also has a Dry Bar special. We've had Dusty Slay, who has been on every late night show. Great dude. And then we're going to have coming up some of my favorite comics from the area that people may not know, but they should. And so you'll get to hear a little bit of them coming up. And then we've got some other fun stuff planned after that.
Awesome. And you know, I've said this to you, so I can say it publicly. It's one of my favorite shows that we put out on the network is Convince Me of Larry Smith. So go check it out. Over on Beyond the Mouse, we have had quite a few busy months for us of guests and everything like that. Way back on Christmas, we were interviewing Rolly Crump, who is a Disney legend, who really helped bring about a lot of the attractions on the theme park that you're aware of today, whether that be in Disneyland or Walt Disney World. We also recently talked to John Kennedy, who is a puppeteer as well. He was Sinclair, Baby Sinclair's eyes on Dinosaurs. So after this releases, I don't know exactly when this will be releasing, but Dinosaur is going to be available on Disney Plus starting on January 29th. So you can definitely go check his work out. He was in From Pilot to Finale. He was with that show. Great interview as well. We always talk all things Disney on that show as well. We have a very big announcement that's going to be coming on our social media feeds and on the Front Row Network feeds as well. I want to do a little bit of a teaser there for you. Any final thoughts before we wrap this thing up, Larry?
I just think this was a great opportunity to get to talk to a working actor. And, you know, so often you're afraid to meet people like that because you don't know how they're going to be. And I was 100% not disappointed. What a great dude Connor is. Yeah.
Just great. And Connor, if you're listening back to this, thank you again. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you for Dead Eyes. Thank you for the podcast. We love it. We will listen to it here until you're all done with the series. And then we'll probably go back and listen to it a couple more times after that. So thank you again. And for the Front Row Network, I am Craig.
And I'm Larry.
And we will see you in the front row.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio Illinois. For more from the Front Row Network, including our articles or our other dozens of shows, visit thefrontrownetwork.com or nprillinois.org/programs/frontrownetwork. You can also find us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram, and on Twitter @FrontRowReviews with a Z.